So anytime you're ready, we can go ahead.
So I'm going to, okay. The question of reputation, to the extent that it had ever interested me before this episode, had done so for purely literary or antiquarian reasons. It belonged, I assumed, to a bygone world where communications were imperfect and social arrangements consequently more dependent on trust and hearsay than they are now. In the past, your name, what other people could report about you, was crucial to your survival, whether you were a medieval knight or an Elizabethan merchant or a Victorian governess. A stain on your honor was potentially catastrophic, and so you guarded it jealously and defended it, if necessary, with your life. In our own time, with more efficient information systems at our disposal, we were no longer, I supposed, so much at the mercy of other people's perceptions or opinions. Facts could be checked, rumors and falsehoods refuted. A phone or a plane could bring you into direct contact with a potential business partner or employer. Reputation still meant something, but it no longer meant everything, and no longer required the implied threat of pistols at dawn to underwrite it, or suicide to purge its loss. The insane dueling culture of the past, fights to the death over obscure points of musical criticism, demotion to the ranks for failing to resent an insult, had become obsolete and was fast becoming incomprehensible. People could relax, finally, from the state of coiled-up vigilance in which those who wished to get on in the world had spent their lives for so many centuries. And yet it seems that sometime near the end of the 20th century, by a curious quirk of scientific progress, history in this regard reversed course. The internet emerged, and with it, the arbitration of reality began to pass back from the realm of verifiable fact to that of rumor and report, from the actual to the virtual. The latter, an indiscriminate tumult of truth and lies, was the zone in which our public identities, our outer selves, once again began to assume their definitive form. There was the private self still, but for anyone who interacted with the world, there was this strange new emanation of yourself, your internet presence, and it was by this, increasingly, that others knew you and judged you. Very quickly, it was discovered that you could manipulate it, glamorize your image, finesse your biography. And by the same token, you could manipulate other people's presences, boost an ally's standing, or launch a corrosive lie against an enemy. One would think that the ease of performing such manipulations, and the large scale on which they immediately began occurring, would have long ago discredited the web as a source of information about anything. But although we all acknowledge the need to be cautious, to discount much of what we read, split the difference between conflicting statements and so on, our first instinct, being creatures of the word, is to trust it. And even on deeper consideration, we tend to feel that it is basically more right than wrong, and that we can accept its approximations as the truth. You are what the web says you are, and if it misrepresents you, the feeling of outrage, anguish, of having been violated in some elemental layer of your existence is, as I began to learn, peculiarly crushing.
That is great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before we go on, I should just ask about one pronunciation. Nazreen?
Nazreen.
Nazreen.
That's how I.
Okay, good. You met the woman you called Nazreen in a fiction writing class you taught nearly a decade ago. What were your first impressions of her?
I thought she was very talented. This was a graduate creative writing class at a very good college in New York, and she stood out. She was writing a novel about her family's experiences fleeing Iran during the 1979 revolution, and she seemed to have a big story to tell and the ability to tell it.
So she was one of the stars of your writing class?
Yeah, absolutely.
And she sought you out for advice on how she should write her story?
Well, she graduated in 2003, and I didn't hear from her for 2 years. In 2005, she got in touch, and she asked if I would help edit her novel. And I wasn't able to do that, but I liked her work enough to feel comfortable recommending her to my agent. My agent didn't sign her up, but she did put her in touch with a freelance editor, and she worked with that freelance editor. And during the course of all this, she and I began an email correspondence. It was very amicable and I admired her work. I really liked her, and we seemed to get on fine. But at a certain point, it became clear that she was expecting this to lead to an affair, and I made it clear that I was happily married. And again, that was fine. She seemed to take it very, very graciously. And I could actually read you some of an email that she sent at that time when I told her this. Mm-hmm. I'm not used to having men lend me support, help, or friendship without any sort of amorous or sexual intentions. I didn't really think that's where you were taking this very benign relationship of ours. So it seemed fine. We continued to correspond, and she continued to work with the editor. But at a certain point, it became clear to me that actually it wasn't all okay and that she was getting obsessed, and her emails grew. Basically, what happened was that there just were more and more of them, and I started answering fewer and fewer of them. And at a certain point, I realized that I was becoming the object of an obsession.
Did you tell her, or did you ask her to back off?
Yes, I did. And she kept saying that I must leave you alone, I must stop this. And I kept waiting for her to do that. I thought, well, she'll ease up, and then maybe we'll be able to sort of be in touch again. And I didn't make a conscious decision that I was going to I wasn't going to write back to her, but I just never had any. There was never any gap between her emails, and I felt at a certain point that it wouldn't be a good idea to keep to write back to her.
So when you said that she was sending you a lot of emails, how many?
There were several a day. I mean, it varied, but this was over many months. And at one point, I went away in the winter, January of 2007. I went with my family, my wife and two kids, to France to do a guidebook. And we were away for 4 months, and we were staying in farmhouses that didn't have internet connection. So I'd only get my email once every few days. And every time I logged on, there'd be 20, 30, 40 emails from her. And, you know, by now I was disturbed by it, but I was also very busy with this guidebook, and there wasn't much I could do about it. I read some of the emails. They seemed sort of harmless in themselves, but the quantity of them was what was disturbing at that point. And then we got back in June of 2007 or July, and almost overnight, suddenly one day, well, it was overnight, actually, she suddenly turned from these fairly innocuous emails to vitriolic hate mail and accusations, first of all, of that I'd plagiarized her work in a story of mine, then later accusations of sexual misconduct. Then she began widening her target to include my agent and this editor she had worked with. A woman in her 70s, and my agent, I think, is a woman in her 60s. And we were all, according to her, part of a Jewish conspiracy to steal her work and sell it to other writers, American writers of Iranian descent. And she started sending violently anti-Semitic emails to the three of us, as well as everything else.
And she actually called what she was doing verbal terrorism, which seems like a pretty good description.
Well, she had a way with words. And I had never come across that phrase before. I don't know if she invented it, but she was quite capable of it. She had a sort of pithy turn of phrase. And I think it was very accurate, too. I mean, words were her weapon. And she was conducting, I think, from her point of view, asymmetric warfare. I mean, she regarded herself as somebody very powerless, and me particularly as somebody powerful, a published author with something to lose. And she, I think, felt she had nothing to lose. Where the anti-Semitism came from, I do not know. I mean, there was no sign of it before. It's one of the mysteries about her that partly the book. I mean, the book is very much an attempt to understand what happened, what was going on with her, what I brought to the situation.
Well, and the irony from the way you write about this is that while you're Jewish, you don't sort of actively identify as Jewish. I mean, that doesn't seem to be a big part of your identity.
Well, I'm not religious in any way, and I was brought up in a very assimilated English Jewish household. I mean, my parents, my father was an architect. He was quite well known, and he did publicly identify as a Jew, but it wasn't part of our lives. And that was one of the strange things about this, to be a not very sort of active Jew who was at the receiving end of this onslaught of anti-Semitism, and it made me think about all that and the extent to which one's identity is something that other people impose on one almost as much as what one feels oneself. And that's historically often been the case with Jews, that it's as much a construct of people who are in some way hostile towards Jews as it is their own identity.
Why do you think Nazreen was so obsessed with you? I mean, she was fixated on you, I mean, to the point where she was doing everything she could to try to smear you. I mean, she must have spent hours and hours and hours trying to construct this campaign against you.
Well, it is a mystery. And I in the course of writing the book, I mean, she conducted a pretty sort of methodical, systematic smear campaign. She began posting things on websites about me, these various allegations. And then she sort of developed after that. She escalated to physical threats and things. But the question of why it's very hard to answer, but in the process of writing the book, one of the things that I thought about that I hadn't really thought about at the time was the possible impact of my having fallen silent. I think it was possibly more upsetting, more disturbing to her than I realized at the time. It wasn't, as I said, I didn't take this deliberate decision, I am no longer going to respond to these emails. But that is what happened. And perhaps that was traumatic in some way. But I don't think it accounts for 5 years of unrelenting hate mail and threats and identity theft and all the rest of the stuff she did. And I think there's a part of the picture that is to do with personality disorder, some kind of imbalance. Although I'm not qualified to make a diagnosis, and I only half believe in the categories of personality disorder as they're described in the manual of mental illness, the diagnostic manual of mental health. I believe that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. I prefer to
look at it through the lens of what I do know, which is literature and myth and poetry and my own experience as a writer.
This is very much a story of the internet age. I mean, what she was able to do, I mean, sort of spread these emails, not just to you, but to lots of people you knew, to start posting on websites where you had been published. And I guess one of the sobering lessons of all of this is it's quite easy to spread malicious gossip, and it's not very, and it's not at all easy to figure out how to counteract that.
It is. I mean, that's one of the things the internet brings with it. It's this amazing new medium, this amazing new technology, but it does facilitate new forms of harm as well, I think. And I think it may possibly have brought into being a new kind of stalker, somebody who might not have done this kind of thing before. I think it allows people who think of themselves or who are powerless in the real world to be very powerful. I mean, it's very easy to put malice out there and to have it spread far and wide and to do quite a bit of damage to people in ways that might not have been possible before. I mean, there were stalkers before, of course, but I think the person who would physically stalk you is a different kind of person. I mean, I think somebody who does cyber stalking might not be a physical stalker. They might not want to expose themselves to that kind of danger. And I even think phone stalking is a slightly different thing because there's a filter, I suppose, that happens when you talk into speech that might inhibit some people. Whereas the internet, email, online postings is a very direct, it's almost as if your unconscious is expressing itself directly. It's almost like telepathy. You can just send out these impulses of hatred or whatever, and there's no kind of inhibiting filter between you and the recipient. So I think for people who are very impulsive and are swayed by incredibly powerful feelings that they can't control, it offers a kind of irresistible form of expression.
Now, one thing that Nazarene did is she contacted your professional colleagues or other students you had taught, I mean, basically spreading these rumors about you. How did they respond?
Well, it was hard to know because she was contacting professional associates of mine, and I didn't always hear about it till quite late in the day. And I think the people who knew me knew that what she was saying was not true. But for instance, she sent a long email denouncing me for all sorts of crimes to a head of department at a place where I taught. And I don't think he believed them, but I think anybody in his position has to take this kind of thing seriously, can't just dismiss it out of hand. So there was this very uncomfortable moment where he came to me and said, we've had a rather strange email about you. And I had to talk him through the whole story. And I found it incredibly uncomfortable.
Well, he must have assumed there must be some shred of truth in her charges. Maybe not the whole thing, but there's something there.
Well, I think that's the problem you're up against, anyone in my position is up against in this kind of situation. The fair-mindedness of other people, the feeling that where there's smoke, there must be some kind of fire. And that's part of what makes it so difficult to defend yourself against. But after that, I felt the need. I did realize how vulnerable I was and how much real damage could be being done by these emails and these postings. And the book actually began as an attempt to write a document. I thought if I could post on my website a document that would just lay out in just very simple, clear detail exactly what had happened, reproduce all the emails she'd sent me, some of which were very lucid and some of which were very crazy, but which sort of cumulatively showed somebody who was clearly not altogether rational. Then I thought that would the next time a boss took me aside and said, we had a strange email about you, at least I'd be able to say, well, read this and then we'll talk about it. Read this posting on my website and then we'll talk about it. But oddly, in the course of doing that, I came up against this other difficulty, which is if you write a document in your own defense, you sound defensive and you sound a little bit crazy too. At least that's to my ear how it sounded when I started writing this thing and started imagining how other people would react reading it.
Well, what's fascinating about the way you write about this whole thing is that it seeped into every part of your life. I mean, you say that it was hard to read books. It was hard to write. It was hard to play with your kids without wondering what Nazarene was up to next. Tell me about that. I mean, how far did it get you?
Well, she did have this strange ability to keep inventing new ways to upset me and torment me. And there were the accusations, there were the postings, and then she started impersonating me in emails. If you forward something from a magazine, you can pretend to be anybody in the box that it has you fill out where it asks you to put in your email address. So she would pretend to be me and sending obscene messages to other people. So I was constantly wondering, well, what is she going to do next? And I did become as I say in the book, I became almost as obsessed with her as she was with me. And that in many ways was the worst part of it. It was the way it took over my mind, my thoughts, and really did make it very hard to do anything else at all except sit there wondering what was going on and how could I stop it? And what was going to happen next? That was very upsetting. When you can't stop thinking about something, I had never been in that situation before. I mean, maybe for short times here and there, but not over a sustained period of time. And it's very disturbing.
Well, you say it also started to seep into your creative life. I mean, it affected what you wrote about, and in some ways, it actually freed you up to write some things that you had been blocked about writing before.
Well, things that I had been trying to write kept turning into this story because it had such a sort of powerful gravitational pull that even stories that I'd begun writing before this experience began started turning into it. It became clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to write about anything else. And, you know, I began writing this document that I was originally intending to post on a website just as a sort of forensic document to defend myself against these accusations. And in the process of doing that, I realized I couldn't write that document, but I did start getting interested in writing the story from a more literary point of view because it touched on so many things that interested me and had interested me for many years. And made them... Well, I've always been interested in the idea of reputation in these different layers of the self. You know, reputation is a layer of oneself. It happens to be a layer that you can't control. It's sort of in the hands of other people. And so I was interested in that. There were various memories that I wanted to write about. My father... he had experienced. He was an architect, and he'd been commissioned to design a synagogue once in Jerusalem. And he spent 4 years going back and forth between London and Jerusalem. And it didn't get built in the end. But he published his design, and he was sent some violently anti-Semitic email, which he took me aside when I was about 20 and showed me. And we were both kind of appalled. And he sort of just that, but that was that. He put it away. And I found myself remembering that chapter of my father's life. And thinking again about what it is to be Jewish, if you're not really a practicing Jew, is it just something that you feel when somebody sends you something like this? you know, I had been interested somewhat in that before, but it really focused my mind getting you know this firestorm of anti-Semitic emails, which in many ways that was the least personally upsetting. I mean, it was awful stuff, but it, you know, I didn't feel vulnerable as a Jew to this. You know, living in the States. I mean, it wasn't like I'm sort of part of some terribly vulnerable minority. But it interested me, and because she kept sort of elevating the terms of it, she was somewhat had a tendency to aggrandize everything she did. So she began with sort of basic anti-Semitism, and then. After a while, I was responsible for all the problems in the Middle East. And I became interested in the politics of it, the gradations between criticisms of Israel and where or if that ever shades into a kind of anti-Semitism, and if so, at what point. These questions began to interest me quite a bit. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, she also attacked you as a writer. I mean, she called you a mediocre writer. She said you had stolen material, not only from the novel she was writing, but also appropriated bits of her life. And, I mean, basically, she was calling you a fraud, which, you know, at one level, obviously, this is absurd. But I guess I'm wondering if it ever got under your skin to the point where you were wondering if she was right.
Well, she really understood insecurity, and I don't think I'm alone as a writer in having all those kinds of insecurities. You do wonder if you're a fraud. You do wonder if you're any good. If you're, you know, I mean, all those. And you know, you have to be fantastically confident never to wonder about those things. And when somebody whose work you have admired and somebody who clearly has some kind of literary sensibility, as she did. Is hurling this stuff at you. It does, you know, it connects with something. It's not that I felt, oh, God, she's right. I'm going to stop. But it rubs at something in you that's already sensitive and became, yeah, another part of the unpleasantness of the experience.
So how bad did it get? What was your lowest point?
The worst things she did were probably the threats that she made against my family. She tried to contact my daughter, and she sent some pretty violent threats, and that was extremely disturbing and worrying.
There was also, I mean, there were also the questions about your public reputation. I mean, she was spreading rumors, all kinds of malicious things about you on public websites.
Well, yes. And I mean, she put things on Amazon, on Goodreads. I review books for The Guardian. And, you know, if you The Guardian, like any other paper, has a comment section where anybody can post whatever they want. One day I looked at the comment section of a review I had written, and there was a posting from her, and I'll read you a part of what she said. "Mr. Lasden, your own personal life is a bad porn film, and I'm sorry I didn't sleep with you, and so you had me raped and gave my work to APAC babies for dollars." And that was just a part of it. Now, I mean, I don't know how long it had been up there, and I pressed the you know, you can hit the kind of offensive content button or whatever, and I did that, and it was taken down in time. But I realized how vulnerable I was, and how if I was going to have to be. I mean, sorry. One of the things that I was struck by then was that I was either going to have to become sort of permanently vigilant and be forever Googling myself, which is not something I like to do, or else develop an incredibly thick skin and not mind about being publicly accused of those kinds of crimes. And I don't have that kind of a thick skin. I mean, I find it really upsetting. I mean, some of the websites she posted things on were very obscure websites, but The Guardian is a very widely read newspaper, both online and off. And I there was no way that I could sort of get my head around being okay about that kind of accusation. And that was one of many things that made me feel that I was not only justified in writing this book, but that I had to.
Well, at one point, you contacted the FBI to see if you had legal grounds to stop this harassment. Was that helpful?
I actually contacted the FBI fairly early on, soon after the anti-Semitic stuff began. I thought, well, this must be a hate crime, rather naively, and I called them up. And it turned out that, you know, it has to be a lot. There's a lot more to a hate crime than just that. It has to be combined with very specific death threats to do with the fact that I was Jewish and the rest of it. So it was hard to get the FBI interested. I mean, they were sympathetic. The person I spoke to, he told me at all costs to keep reading the emails, but not to reply to them, and to see if they rose to the level of a hate crime as he defined it. They never really did.
But they actually contacted her on your behalf, basically saying she better lay off.
Well, that was actually a detective at the NYPD. That was a little later on. I and the other two women who were also receiving some of this stuff were put in touch with a detective at the NYPD. And he was very sympathetic. He said there's not very much they could do because she had moved to California, and what she was doing was aggravated harassment, which is a misdemeanor, not a felony. And they don't usually extradite people for misdemeanors. But he offered to call her up and basically try to talk her into stopping it, or scare her into stopping it. He said it would be a little bit of a bluff. And he did call her up, and it did stop things for a while. But she started up again. And then she realized she wasn't going to get into any serious trouble.
Didn't she kind of twit you on that? Sort of like, oh,
yeah,
go ahead, sue me.
Yeah, pretty much. She found the whole thing very funny. I think she was enjoying what she was doing. She was very conscious of doing harm and very open about enjoying it. And since the book since I finished the book, the case has now been taken up by a detective at the hate crimes unit of the NYPD, and he's again been very sympathetic. He's more or less up against the same problem, but her emails have become more violent, and theoretically, it is possible that they could extradite her now.
So she is still. I mean, your book is out. She is still sending you emails. I mean, she's still trying to smear you.
I haven't heard from her since August of 2012. She actually moved on from email to voice messages on our phone. And there was a spate of extremely violent voicemails in August. And I had to listen to them all because I had to digitally record them for this detective at the NYPD. And but I haven't heard from her since then. And I haven't heard from her since the book has come out. So it's... But she's been quiet for months in the past. I mean, there was a period of several months when she went quiet, and I thought, it's over, perhaps. And I was getting cautiously optimistic. And then I had to go to L.A. To do a reading, and she lives, I think, near L.A., and she must have seen a listing or something. And she started up again with very, very violent emails. And at a certain point, I realized I was going to have to tell the organizers of the reading that I had a stalker, and which was not something you really want to do when somebody's invited you to do a reading. But this being L.A., it wasn't something terribly novel to them. I mean, they were all it's pretty run of the mill in L.A. for people to have stalkers, I guess. So, you know, I did the reading under guard with the LAPD patrolling outside, and nothing happened, and I went home. But that's just sort of part of how life was becoming, and it was very strange and very crazy and not at all pleasant.
Now, one of the ways that you tried to cope with all of this is to go back to literature, and you say that you found sustenance in some of your favorite books, and one of them was the story from King Arthur's Court, Gawain and the Green Knight. Can you explain the connection there?
Well, the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight has always been one of my favorite works of literature. It's one of the great tales of psychological combat, and it's a story of somebody who stakes everything, and is tested to the absolute limits of his endurance, both in terms of physical courage and psychological courage. And it's also a story of men and women and what goes on between them, the pull,
All right.
Just kidding.
Well, this is a story Sir Gawain meets this strange Green Knight, and they sort of make this strange deal that the Green Knight says, go ahead, chop my head off, and with the idea that, you know, with the arrangement that, you know, I then get to chop your head off at some later date. And so Gawain does that, but the guy doesn't die. And so then Gawain knows that at the appointed date, he has to go and meet the Green Knight and go to his death. And, I mean, it's a chilling story because it's all about preparing for your own destruction.
That's right. He's somebody who does have to accept the inevitability of his own destruction if he's not going to be a coward. He has to go and meet his fate. And in the course of doing that, he becomes, in many ways, the first really modern hero. He becomes inward-looking, alienated from his own community, anxious, brooding, beginning to understand that life is quite a bit more complicated than he had ever thought it was, and part of what he goes through is he arrives at a castle, and the lord of the castle's wife begins to try to seduce him, and there are these very powerful seduction scenes where he's resisting but tempted. And I found that very interesting too, as a way of talking about just the kinds of relationships one gets into without really looking ahead. And then there was another aspect of the story that interested me quite a bit, which is its relationship to the uncanny. One of the things that I experienced during this whole ordeal was a feeling of being out of my depth, as I said, not being able to control what I thought about. And when that's happening to you, it's almost as if you're under a kind of curse or a spell. And I'm totally rational and not superstitious or anything like that. And I don't. It's hard for me to write about those kinds of things because I don't really believe in them. But one of the things that Sir Gawain gave me was a kind of means of approaching that very, to me, very, very strange, bizarre feeling of being caught in something psychologically very, very powerful and very mysterious. So it touched on my story in many ways, and I sort of wove it into the story. So did other works of literature. There's a novel by Isaac Singer. There's Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train, which is one of the great stories of stalking, of how two people meet and the relationship becomes steadily more toxic, and one begins to stalk the other very, very, very relentlessly, and insinuates himself into the hero's life to the point where it's almost takes it over completely.
These sound kind of frightening, these stories.
Well,
I'm not sure if there's much relief to be gained here.
Well, Strangers on a Train is a terrifying story. There's nothing, I can't pretend any different. It's a wonderful novel. So Gawain is not terrifying in that way. It's rather beautiful, and it deals with quite frightening things, but it makes something very beautiful out of them, and it ends at a place where, you know, it's not all terrible and bleak. It's a rather complex ending. The hero survives, but he survives very much burdened by the understanding of what he's by the experience that he has gone through. It has transformed him completely, and I could relate to that.
I'm curious about your decision to write this book. Now, on the one hand, it's the ultimate revenge for you. I mean, it's your public defense against Nazreen. And yet, on the other hand, the fact that you have written this is acknowledging the power that she had over you. You know, she made you suffer. And to some degree, maybe you can make the case she won. I don't know. How did you sort this out?
Well, those are all very valid points, except that it's not in any way a work of revenge. It's not an attack on her. I see it as it's quite sympathetic in many ways, and I tried to do justice to her. I mean, obviously, her words, her emails are pretty damning. But even aside from that, I think she does emerge as a kind of force. And I wanted to understand what was going on as much as possible from her point of view as well as my own. So I don't see it in any way as a revenge or as an attack. As far as writing it, publishing it, I mean, writing it, as I said, was the first thing that gave me any kind of relief from the experience itself was the act of writing about it. That was, you know, 3 or 4 years into it, I began writing about it.
Because you are a writer. This is what you do.
And as I said, I couldn't write about anything else. And I initially felt I needed a document to defend myself, but that's not what it turned out to be. It turned out to be something that had a lot more layers in it than just a simple story of being stalked. But it did give me some relief from the experience itself to be able to write about it. But, you know, there's writing about it, then there's publishing it. And they're two, it's particularly in a book like this, they're two very different things. While I was writing it, I wasn't at all sure that anybody would want to publish it, for one thing, or that I would want to publish it, for another. And even after I'd turned it in and it was accepted, there was a period where she went pretty quiet. And I was thinking, well, you know, do I really want to risk stirring all this up again? And I had some serious doubts, and I was wondering whether I should kind of pull it. But then she started up again, and I realized I'm going to have to do this. I mean, I felt justified in doing it. I felt that this is somebody who had very methodically tried to harm me and other people for a very long time, and I felt justified in writing about it. And it would have not been possible to write about it without using her emails. Those were her weapons, and they needed to be part of the story. They are part of the story, and I don't think it would have made any sense without them. Did she, does this make her the victim? Maybe, I don't know. But I feel I've written a book that I feel satisfied with, and I'm glad that I wrote. But it's not a book I would have chosen to write under normal circumstances. It's not been a comfortable thing to do. It's not an experience I would have sought out. But as a writer, you do respond to the experiences that life presents you with.
Well, it's an incredible book. Thank you very much for having written it.
Thank you.
And this was great. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, good. Thanks. Okay. I wish you well.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.